Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, how sweet is a $6,000 gaming PC? Did OCZ pull a bait and switch with IndieLinks? Will SSD caching drive make your PC faster? Asus ROG Maximus 5G, big name for a tiny motherboard. And hey, Ivy Bridge is coming. And we've got GTX 690 and Tegra 4 leaks. Really? It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 165, recorded April 12th, 2012. SSD bait and switch?
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Gorton. We're going to talk to you about Big Shock, the latest and greatest news in computer hardware, and a little bit of software, occasionally some handheld devices, but mostly we're talking about the best stuff you can put inside your PC, whether your budget is low or high. Joining me, the man, the myth, the benchmarking legend, Mr. Ryan Shrout, freshly returned home from a apparently fast jaunt to Austin. How you feeling, man?
I'm doing all right. Doing okay. Just a couple of days out in Austin, meeting with AMD, learning about some of their stuff that we'll be talking about in the months to come down that side. But recovered here, ready to do the show, and lots to talk about.
Lots to talk about. We should probably start out something that's actually really surprising. OCZ, the IndieLinks drives, are actually Marvell hardware. So they're not using the controller you thought they were using, or are they using a special version of the firmware that was cooked up to run on the Marvell hardware? It's a little kind of a curious story coming out right after OCZ. What's going on, man?
Well, see, IndieLinks, the reason this became a story is because IndieLinks used to make its own controller. Like they were one of the original SSD kind of controller brands, and they kind of got passed up by the likes of SandForce and Intel and those guys. And then we saw OCZ buy IndieLinks, and they said, you know, we're going to make these controllers. And you know, they actually didn't really give a whole lot of detail on what they were going to plan on doing with the IndieLinks name. What we didn't expect them to do was basically license a Marvell controller and then just put a new name on it, which is what it turns out is what they have done. There's nothing necessarily wrong there. The Marvell controller is obviously doing very well. We were impressed with the Vertex 4. We were impressed with the OCZ Octane, which came out last year sometime, I guess middle of last year. And because when the Octane came out, it was actually the first, it was actually November of last year. It was like the first, okay, here's the revitalization of the IndieLinks name. It did very well. They priced it very aggressively. And then when the Vertex 4 came out, when we talked about it last week or 2 weeks ago on this show, we were like, okay, right, well, now it's interesting. We've actually gone from SandForce controllers back to an IndieLinks controller. And as it turns out, that's apparently not the case. What we're actually looking at is Marvell hardware, Marvell controller with different modified firmware. As Alan wrote in this news post, it's clear that IndieLinks is cranking out some great firmware for this hardware, but it's a surprise to us that the IndieLinks arm of OCZ chose to go this route as opposed to spinning their own next generation controller. It seems to me it kind of points to this shrinking of the market, but this is combinations of the market, right? Where Intel is now using a SandForce controller for their high-end product as well. They're not making their own separate controller right now. IndieLinks is not making its own SATA 6G controller either. And instead, we're getting a Marvell controller with modified firmware that makes it stand out from the other Marvell drives. So to the end user, I don't think this really affects anything. This was the only place you could get the IndieLinks controllers was through these OCZ lines of solid-state drives. So it's not like you kind of have to change the comparisons you were making from other designs or anything like that in the past. So it's just now people know the truth, whether or not it will affect their sales or their, you know, it's obviously not going to affect their performance or anything like that. But I think it may have, I don't know, people don't like being lied to. They don't like feel like they're being tricked into buying something with, but, you know, in my mind, it's like, if it's a good card and it's a good firmware and it's a good SSD, I don't really care what the name on it is, as long as it's working and functioning correctly.
Well, it's kind of funny. This is such a GPU-like type situation, because so many cases we see, you know, GPUs are essentially using the design, that the reference design that comes from the chip manufacturer. They slap their label on it. You know, I don't even think I don't think anybody making graphics cards right now does much in the way of firmware modification other than tweaking settings for overclocking. But it's an interesting idea. The first thing I saw when I read this, I'm like, wow, does that mean I have the possibility of running the IndieLynx firmware on a non-OCZ hard drive that's running a Marvell controller to take advantage of the performance opportunities? I'm also really curious to find out whether or not, you know, IndieLynx is working, if they're working on a controller in the background that's like skipping a couple generations, or if they've just flat out given up on it and decided that optimizing the firmware for other people's controllers is the big opportunity for them.
Right, it's interesting. My guess would be that they're not working on any other controllers anymore. That would be my just off the cuff guess, and that they're going to use the IndieLynx brand as just that. They're going to use it as a brand in order to stand out from everybody else that makes a Marvell based SSD. Right. And maybe there's some benefit to that. So now you don't just say, here's an OCZ drive with a Marvell controller and better firmware. Now you can say, here's an IndieLynx Everest 2, right? And it's a little bit kind of backwards in terms of what you're saying, because it's, if you translate it out, it's an OCZ drive with a Marvell controller with a better firmware, but now they have a better way to brand it and kind of make it their own. I think it's just going to depend on what users' thoughts are on this kind of trickery happening or whatever, if they consider that at all.
Yeah, I think in most cases, I think people are walking up to a wall of drives or looking at a giant list on Newegg and just grabbing whatever's available or whatever got a good recommendation. I mean, it'll be curious to see if that... I don't see... OCZ has such momentum in the market right now, I don't see a whole lot knocking at that. We will find out. I'm going to nominate this for the most out-of-control name of a motherboard in recent memory, the Republic of Gamers, the Asus ROG, Republic of Gamers Maximus 5 Gene motherboard, which for some reason has me thinking of Game of Thrones, since I was watching Game of Thrones on Blu-ray last night. Just this sort of, you know what I mean? Like, look at it. It's funny. It's a micro ATX motherboard running Intel Z77 chipset. So you're supporting LGA 1155 processors, PCI Express Gen 3. And if you start looking down, kind of an interesting idea, all I can think of is like, wow, is that a riser card? The MPCI Express combo card. So it'll actually run mSETA and the mini PCI Express cards on there. So it's interesting. You will not have to, you know, block the PCI Express slots. You basically, both PCI Express slots will be available for gaming on this, which makes me wonder if you can find a decent, if you're going to be able to find a decent micro ATX case that's going to hold both of the graphics cards inside.
Oh, sure.
It's kind of a little, well, you know what I mean? Like, I always think of, you know, you always think of these little boards as being these little flat cases that are so stylish, and then you're going to have two gigantic GPUs sticking out the top of it. But it looks like a really clean layout, which is always really nice to see.
Yeah, it looks like a good board. Now, the Gene is a series of boards from ASUS. This is always kind of like, so the ROG is their high-end brand, and then you've got Formula, which is kind of like the mid-range for full-size ATX. You've got Gene, which is the micro ATX. And, obviously the Maximus 5, they've gone through five different generations of chipsets with this, so it's the product branding, I guess, kind of direction has been around for a while. But this, you know, we're starting to see Z77 motherboards really being pushed out there, really being promoted. The base information you need to know is the Z77 changed from Z68. The only difference from the Intel chipset department is going to be that these new motherboards are going to have integrated USB 3.0 support on board So then now vendors will either not have a third-party controller, or they'll have a third-party controller giving you more USB 3.0 points of access there, so you can have more ports on your computer. But when you get into these high-end boards, you know, you're talking about the PCIe and mSATA combo port. So now you can use one of those mSATA SSDs for SSD caching. You can use it for, if you wanted to put, you know, they sell the mPCIe TV tuners and stuff like that. And you can do that without having to take up your PCI Express slots, which, since this is supposed to be a board aimed at gamers and overclockers and that type of community, you know, they'll want multiple graphics cards in it, even in a micro ATX system, which is pretty impressive to see. We're going to hear a lot more from ASUS about their entire lineup of Z77 motherboards actually pretty soon. So it should be pretty cool. I mean, there's these motherboard vendors are coming to the point where they have to come up with other ways to differentiate. It's been this way for a while, actually. And you can see when we jump from Z68 to Z77, there's only that difference of the integrated USB 3.0 controller on the Intel chipset. So how do they make this motherboard better than last generations? How do they make this motherboard better than their competition's board as well? So we'll be very curious to see kind of what each vendor does to stand out.
I thought it was interesting, you know, looking at, if you go to the rog.asus.com link for the Maximus 5 Gene, you take a look at the audio specs for this are completely out of control. You know, gold-plated jacks, they're claiming 110 decibel signal to noise ratio, co-design, or some technology from Creative EAX in there. And then it's interesting what they're calling, you look at the picture of it, it's like, I think the third one in of that giant still at the top, and you take a look at the Supreme FX3, where they've actually sectioned out the printed circuit board and isolated it by a quote cool red lining of the idea that they're actually going to isolate the analog and digital, basically the audio portions of the board, that they're trying to isolate it as much as possible from the remainder.
They put it kind of in a different layer of the PCB.
Really cool idea. You know, whether or not you'll actually be able to hear the difference remains to be seen, but you know, I think you nailed it on the head. They're working really, really hard to try to differentiate. You know, Intel Gigabit Ethernet, that they're claiming has 35% lower CPU overhead. Not that it's kind of like, you know, there's so few things that actually tax your CPU at this point anymore. But, you know, really nice looking board. I like the fact that you can do a BIOS update a BIOS backup over the USB. And they made all of the switches really easy to access on the motherboard, which is a nice change compared to some of the motherboards I've dealt with lately, where you're sitting there like, wow, yeah, let's put the, you know, let's put the reboot switch like between the two, you know, PCI Express risers. So you need to use a stick to reach it if anything goes wrong. So exciting stuff.
Yep.
Tegra 4 specifications are leaking. VR-Zone, a Chinese language website, claim they have the leaked specifications for NVIDIA's next system on a chip, the Tegra 4, aimed at mobile tablets. Codenamed Wayne, the new system on a chip will come in several flavors and will arrive next year. Probably all pretty safe guesses at this point. This is where it gets interesting. Quote, 10x the performance of NVIDIA's original Tegra and 5x the performance of the current generation Cal-L Tegra 3 chip. Also says that NVIDIA has run into several hurdles integrating LTE cell radio into their systems on a chip. But if the leaked document is true, the company will finally release a Tegra chip with a built-in LTE 100 and HSPA 42 cell radio capabilities as early as Q3 2013. So, and they're claiming four chip flavors and, quote, the first Tegra 4 chip that manufacturers and consumers will be able to get their hands on as early as Q1 2013. Interesting, interesting stuff. So I'll be curious to see whether or not NVIDIA is hitting their release dates. Although at this point, you basically got a rumor on a website about a chip that hasn't been announced. So take that with a grain. So
what I found is interesting is the performance metric estimates on this leak, 5x current Tegra 3 parts, and it's still a quad core, whatever you want to call it, the 4+1, where you've got the four quad cores and you've got the one, what do they call it? The other process core where it runs background processes and that kind of stuff to save on battery life. So we assume that some of these differences are in clock speeds. We have clock speeds as high as 2 gigahertz on this part listed in this table. And, you know, they're obviously pushing it for tablets as well as for phones, although they do have one not until Q3 of 2013 with LTE integration. So that could hold them back. That could be a pretty serious hardware detriment going forward for the rest of 2012 and 2013 if that turns out to be the case. So
what we need is bigger batteries. Did a ridiculous system review. No, you did a review of a ridiculous system. And that is not particularly ridiculous. It's just that you basically walked up to, you went to main gear, you looked at the shift system. Shift systems start, you know, at a relatively affordable sub $2,000 price range. You freaking packed this thing out to a tab of $6,200. Triple HD 7970, Sandy Bridge E, 16 gigs at Corsair DDR3, Asus Rampage 4 Extreme X79 motherboard. Dual SSDs and a RAID 0 terabyte. And it's kind of funny. Then you get to this like a 1 terabyte Western Digital 7200 RPM hard disk drive, which made me laugh because the system's so over the top that it's got this like, one lonely little 1 terabyte hard drive, a 1200 watt Corsair.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny too.
Power supply, main gear Epic 180 water cooler, main gear Epic audio system, and quote, fancy white LEDs. How did you feel about how did this system stack up? I mean, because you actually have more, this system is worth more than my truck was before I put the new transmission in.
Nice. It.
And this is a very shiny system.
It was incredibly impressive. I mean, you read off the specs there. So we have an idea that this system is going to perform just incredibly well. The flagship item being, of course, the triple Radeon HD 7970 cards running in Crossfire. So graphics performance was through the roof. I think we had a 3D Mark score of like 21,000, which is close to three times the performance of our single GPU testing, right? So you get pretty good scaling on 3D Mark. And it's going to vary from game to game how much actual scaling you get with those three graphics cards. But you look at games like Battlefield 3, Metro 2033, and those games that are very GPU bound, they did scale very, very well with it. You've got Sandy Bridge E, so you don't have to worry about CPU performance. It wasn't overclocked, which is a little bit interesting, right? You can order that option from main gear if you want. You can have them overclock the CPU on.
You've
there.
You've got three 7970s. Do you really need to overclock? I mean, at this point, even if you're running three or four monitors, I mean, how much do you get from overclocking at that point?
Well, it's not really going to affect your gaming very much. You're right. you know, 3.3 up to 3.9 gigahertz Sandy Bridge E processor, you know, 6-core processor is going to be able to handle all that kind of stuff pretty well. And then, you know, you've got the two SSDs in RAID 0, which definitely helped just installation performance, load time performance, installing these games and running these games, that kind of deal. What I thought was interesting, we talked about on this show a lot, you know, you don't need a 1,000-watt power supply, you don't need blah, 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 blah. Well, we hooked this up to the power meter while we were running a couple of games, and we saw like 1,053 watts being drawn from the wall on this system. So yes, this system does need that 1200 watt power supply. so yes, that's why they still make them, everybody. There are systems, crazy people that would buy this $6,000 computer or build one like it on their own do use that much power. So that was nice. The Epic audio system was interesting. This is a third-party technology that they're licensing that they brought in. You've got your motherboard header for the front panel audio connector. You feed that into this device that's kind of based in a 3.5-inch front panel bay on the case. Right. And then they have another cable that goes from that to the actual headphone outputs and microphone inputs actually on the front of the case. So it passes through there. So if you plug it into the back on the motherboard, it doesn't affect anything. You have to plug it in the front for it to affect anything. It actually improves the quality of both of a microphone and of the headphones. And it was a noticeable difference. In terms of audio reviews and that kind of stuff, they're just so subjective. And I listened to both and I felt that the Epic Audio definitely improved the sound, but whether or not it was worth $200 or whatever that option is kind of up in the air. And it all depends, I guess, on personal preference and that kind of stuff too. But it's, as a system builder, it's very difficult to make your products to a system like this. You can go to Newegg and buy almost all of this stuff, right? You can do that. The person that's going to buy a $6,000 computer versus the person who's going to build a $6,000 computer are very different people though. Right. So the person who's going to buy a $6,000 computer doesn't want the hassle of building it, testing it, making sure they've got the right driver versions, making sure the motherboard BIOS and all that kind of stuff's up to date and all that kind of deal. And this works out very well for them. But Main Gear does a good job of, you know, they're trying to find things to be different about, not just compete on pricing and that kind of stuff. Obviously, no company really wants to have to compete on price. So you look at Epic Audio, they've got their own 180 millimeter Epic 180 cooler with self-contained kind of water cooler, which is actually what we use on our GPU test bench. It's really nice, quiet design. They have their own thermal interface, phase change thermal interface type stuff. They're trying to do new things, which I think is, it's difficult to do in this type of PC market. We're competing on margins a lot of ways. And I think they've actually been fairly successful in doing it as well.
It looks like a beautifully built system also, because it's nice. Yeah. It's nice to actually see a boutique system, a high-end system that is for a while there. It seemed like some of the boutique manufacturers were getting overwhelmed and sort of slapping parts in a case. But this looks like it's absolutely beautifully put together. It's pretty. Do you have to send it back?
It is. It's actually in a box over there right now. It's all boxed back up with a different label on it. going back home, I know. Yeah, it sat around the office and people played games on it, and we did it. It's just like, I'm sorry, guys, I gotta unplug it, pack it up.
Let's attach 7 HD TVs to it. Start playing lights and games. So, while we're talking about leaks, NVIDIA, they seem to be kind of the thing, only this time it's a little more personal. The dual GPU GTX 690, maybe. The 680, of course, had a tremendous amount of leaks around it. Benchmarks were accidentally published early. Product pages were posted prematurely. You know, you could argue that that's some sort of crazy branding PR kind of stunt, but I don't think it was. Quote, not many specifications were leaked, although there is not much left that cannot already be assumed about the car due to the similarities with its sister parts. Reference model GTX 690 will require 2 8-pin power connectors. Three will contain 3 DVI ports as well as a mini display port instead of the 6-pin connectors on the GTX 680 and the 2 DVI connectors on the 680. I like Scott's note at the last line of his article. Still, it looks like my 750-watt power supply will survive past May when a leak claims that the GTX 690 is expected to arrive. The estimates based on, it seems like the power estimates are a little kind of all over the map, somewhere between 245 watts and 295 watts in terms of power consumption. Are you excited for this part, or is it just like, another part?
No, I think I'm actually pretty interested in this part. We haven't seen the dual GPU part from AMD, which is kind of surprising, because we actually, when the 79 and 70 first launched, well, when the reviews first went live in December, already were teasing the 7990 and haven't heard anything from them on that, official or unofficial. And I'm kind of worried about it, kind of curious about it. And what is interesting about the 690 is they don't need to release it. They already have at the top, they have the king of the hill type of thing in terms of they have the fastest graphics card available. But the tables have turned, and now NVIDIA has the smaller chip that uses less power and is more efficient, right? So that kind of gives you a leg up when it comes to building a 2 GPU graphics card. When you have the bigger, hotter chip, it becomes more difficult. And you look at the GTX 590, last generation's dual GPU card, you had issues where they had to lower the clocks pretty dramatically on that, on the GF110 parts in there, because of the bigger, hotter design. And now it looks more like AMD may be in that boat, and NVIDIA is on the other side. And if they get their part out in May, it's possible that they'll still beat AMD out to the punch with the dual GPU card. It will without a doubt be the fastest GPU we've ever tested. We'll just have to see what other kind of interesting performance advantages or changes or features that they add to it, in addition to what they added with the GTX 680 a few weeks ago.
You always want a little bit more.
Of course. And it's, you know, it's the dual GPU cards are very much a braggart's card, right? They're like, you could probably get two GTX 680s and you'd be able to do that today. And just it's a little exclusive. It's a little bit like being part of the in crowd, the little, you know, it's part of the special club having one of those cards, because they are somewhat limited in their availability, and you know, the high price makes them limited as well. So
it's always interesting to see what people do with that, because so often you hear about somebody buying a new $500 GPU and attaching it to their single monitor and just being like, is that a 4K monitor? No. Can you go buy two more monitors now? Because you're not doing anything that's going to stress that part, and you're pissing me off. Speaking of pissing me off, yet another Ivy Bridge launch rumor. This time it's CNET. Quote, the first Intel Ivy Bridge launch expected on April 23rd. We know 15-inch Apple MacBook Pros are kind of running out, or the channel seems to be emptying on those. Could be Apple, could be HP, could be Dell, could be Sony, could be Toshiba. We expect staggered rollouts as they bring the chip online and move it across different manufacturers' lineups. But yes, previously seen it, that's been told that the launch would take place between April 23rd and 29th. But right now, if you've been waiting for Ivy Bridge, looks like the end of this month will mark the end of your wait. Ladies and gentlemen, at least for the mobile part.
Yeah.
You know, quad core first and then the power efficient processors. I think it'll be a little interesting to see finally get the full benchmarkable version of the notebooks out and see what they do. And
yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of like, it's great.
I mean, we've seen leaked performance information on right. Ivy Bridge, and I still stand by the premise. If you were, you know, it's worth at this point, if the April 23rd date turns out to be correct, it's worth waiting for, if nothing else. Right. But the CPU side of things isn't going to be dramatically faster. The integrated GPU side of things will be dramatically faster. So it depends on what market you're in. That's why it just makes more sense to be more excited about it in the mobile front than it does necessarily kind of as a desktop gamer application use. So. But either way,
there you have it. We should take a moment to thank the fine folks at Netflix, our sponsor of this episode of Twits, This Week in Computer Hardware. I should also take a moment to remind you that you can always email us your questions, Twitch, TWICH, at twit.tv. But hey, let's stop, take a moment to thank our friends over at Netflix who help us bring you the show every week.
That's right. They're very important because they allow us to continue to talk about computer hardware and that kind of stuff. And, you know, Netflix doesn't make hardware, but they make a great service that I think anybody that uses computers a lot, consumes media, probably everybody else that you're, if you're listening to this, you are consuming media. So I think these they know their demographic. They're hitting it square on the head here. Streaming video, TVs, movies, all that kind of stuff instantly to you, no matter where you are. It saves you time, money, saves you hassle. You don't have to go to a rental store. You don't have to go to a box at a grocery store. Or I've actually seen them at drive-thrus at McDonald's. You don't have to do any of that kind of stuff. You can get it instantly wherever you are at. You can watch streaming Netflix movies and TVs on your Mac, your PC, your iPad, Android phones. Lots of Android phones support it now. If you have a gaming console like a 360 or a PlayStation 3 or Nintendo Wii, you can watch it directly on your TV. You can also watch it on your TV through Blu-ray players, DVD players. A lot of TVs already have Netflix support built into them. So you may already have a device that supports streaming Netflix and not even know it. So get those manuals out, look at those boxes, look up your model on the manufacturer's website and see if it lists those features. Now with Netflix, you get to watch movies and TV shows instantly. You begin watching a movie or show one place, finish it in another place. You can watch the same TV show, same episode, same movie over and over and over again. There's no limit to the amount of the service that you can consume. How many hours do you not need to be at work? I guess that's kind of what the limit's going to be. Or if you can get away watching it at work, whatever. It's not my problem. So they have a lot of really cool features. They have a lot of great content. You should definitely go to netflix.com/twit. You can sign up there, get a free 30-day trial, absolutely free, to try out the service, see if you like it. You still get to watch unlimited shows, unlimited times in that 30-day trial period. So there's no reason not to give it a shot if you have not already. Plus, by going to netflix.com/twit, you support us, supporting them, full circle. We get to come back next week and do the show again, right? So that is key. I think you're really going to love all the time you spend with Netflix. So again, that URL, netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and the entire Twit network. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Netflix. Brian's got a question about emails? Yeah, absolutely. I was sorry. As I leapt right into Brian, I'm laughing because Lloyd Case and I were talking about a very similar question on Techzilla this week. Brian's got a question about cache and drives. He says, I have questions about the new SSD cache drives I've been seeing. Drives like the OCZ Synapse, the Crucial Adrenaline, or Corsair Accelerator. These drives are sold with Win 7 software that will cache frequently used data itself to speed up Windows. The drives are in the $100 range and allow me to add it to my current rig without rebuilding Windows or buying a new motherboard. I want to know, how well do the drives and the bundled software work? Are they on par with the Intel SRT technology? I'm sure they are not as good as having an SSD as the boot, but how do they compare? The idea of having SSD-like performance without having to manage which applications or game is on which drive is really appealing to me. We also appreciate the idea that I will not have to tell my wife where to save her files. Thanks for the great show. I love hearing about the latest and greatest graphics cards every week. Brian. Thanks, Brian. And hey, we'll have more graphics cards for you in the immediate future.
Yeah, no joke. This is an interesting question. Yeah, because there's different options, right? You have an SSD as your main drive, and you have secondary drives. You could go with the Intel chipset based solution, right, where it uses what they call SRT technology, and then you do have these other companies, OCZ Synapse, Corsair's Accelerator, which we just got one of those in just a little bit ago, that use third-party software, and you can even do it after you've installed Windows. So you just add the SSD in, install the software, and you're off and running. You don't have to kind of reformat and reinstall Windows, which you kind of have to do if you want to do the Intel route, that type of thing. So what did you guys talk about on Techzilla about this issue?
Basically talking about the 77 boards that were coming, and that it actually is worth it to, you know, put, especially if you have a rotating media drive, to take advantage of the slot, put it on there, or use a SATA port to put a caching drive on there, simply because it, you know, on top of like, okay, you know, your $6,200 machine you were just talking about has 16 gigabytes of RAM. Yes, Windows 7, Windows 8 will cache your most frequently used data into the system memory that's not being used. But, of course, it has to be reloaded every time. You know, if you have an SSD, the using a caching SSD drive, a second SSD drive for caching, not going to help you out that much. Rotating media, it can make a huge difference in startup performance, Windows startup performance, application startup. But yeah, if you already have an SSD, probably not going to enjoy it that much. If you don't have an SSD and you want an SSD-like performance boost, for $100, you have an opportunity to do some really nice things to the way you're – it's kind of that classic wake your system up. You know, give yourself a nice performance hit, a nice perceivable performance hit, especially if you're constantly rebooting your system and reloading certain apps or certain large files. These have some, you know, advantages. If you already have an SSD in your system, probably not going to help you all that much.
Yeah, no. If you already have an SSD in your system, don't worry about these types of drives. I think the main advantage of these non-Intel solutions is that you can install it after the fact. Which I say that, but there is a way to do that with the Intel kind of SRT stuff, but it's not as straightforward, and it's not meant to be installed that way. You have to enable RAID and create an array without destroying data and blah, blah, blah. It's possible, but it's not exactly user-friendly. These are much more user-friendly devices, and they're inexpensive, and it's hard to argue with that. So I would say for $100, it's worth giving a shot, right? So I think OCZ and Corsair's accelerator drive that we just had in, they have like a 60 gig model that might be, you know, $120 or something like that, that fits in exactly with this idea here. So Brian, give that a shot.
Cheap.
Here is another SSD email actually from Mark asking about the Crucial M4. He says, so I'd love an SSD in my new Sony Vaio S, but it has a 640 gig drive that I need to replace with at least 500 gigs, with at least a 500 gig SSD. I tend to dual boot Windows 7 and Linux, or Windows 8 as well, as keep my music collection and a few movies on it for travel. The Crucial M4 is now down to $529 on Amazon for the 512 gigabyte model. I just can't see dropping another $250 on Samsung or Intel or similar drive. Is the Crucial drive that inferior? It has 4.5 stars on Amazon. It basically hit the buck a gig price point I've been waiting for. I need a big drive. Thanks. Love the show and congratulations on your newborn, Patrick. Did that about 20 years ago, and they're a lot easier when they're little and a lot cuter.
Thank you, Slash. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So I've been trying to find this drive for that price on Amazon, and I've been unsuccessful because I would have bought one. To be perfectly honest with you. So
your first thought is like, don't worry about OCZ. Don't worry about Intel. If you are worried about reliability, back up regularly. And yes, get this. It's a sick deal. Because I'm seeing it, yeah, $700 on average. Although, you know, sometimes, you know, one of the most frustrating things and one of the most amazing things about Amazon is they run specials. They run gold box specials. They run, you know, partner specials. They run, the other day I needed a lawnmower, right? We bought a house. There's a lawn. I've known the lawnmower since I was freaking 15 and running a landscaping business. You know, and so I'm looking for one of those push mowers, the real gang mowers, the real mower where you're basically pushing it mechanically with your body instead of using a motor. And all of a sudden up on Amazon for 59 minutes, it's going to be like $60 off and I can get it shipped to my house, you know, overnight for $4. And that's one of the frustrating things about Amazon is like if they have a deal, they might have a deal right now for the next hour. And when you go back, the deal's not there anymore. Because, I am not seeing the Crucial M4 in 512 gigabytes for less than $700.
I see it on Amazon for $631.35, which is $1.23 a gig, according to my calculator right here, which is still pretty good, because usually when you get into higher capacities, you're actually paying more per gigabyte just because of the density of the flash that they have to use. I don't have any problems with the M4s. They're a little bit kind of, I mean, they're still set as 6 gig drives, so they're not even like old drives. I haven't had any or heard of any really negative problems with these at all. And when you're talking about 413 customer reviews on Amazon, that's a pretty good indication usually of if people are having a lot of problems. What I tend to do, just go read the reviews. See which ones are the one star. See who's bringing it down out of its five-star potential rating and see what they're saying. If they say it doesn't work with this motherboard, it doesn't work with this platform, or it died with all of my data all of the time type of thing. Those would be bad reviews. But You'll see some drive failed type of things, but you'll see that on standard hard drives and on any SSD. So you're going to have to pay a lot to replace a 640 gig drive. I don't think there's any way to get around it.
Yeah, but that was an especially good deal you saw up there. Brent's got a question about pixel density. He says, guys, still like what I hear, so thank you for making drive time tolerable. Thanks for listening, Brent. So I have two 1920 by 1200 screens, one 1920 by 1080 screen. One of the 1920 screens is a 25.5 inch. The other is a 15.4 inch laptop. Speaking of pixel density, the 1080 screen is a 24 inch monitor. Part numbers can be provided in a later email. Here's the problem. Arranging screens in Windows 7. Screen size uses a fixed pixel per inch. Laptop display does not conform to pixels per inch. Results cursor position off when moving across all three screens. My Google Foo did not find a fix, but I expect hope for better from you guys. That's an interesting problem.
The only way I know, I think, do you get around it is with custom resolutions, like where you don't. If your monitor allows you to set non-standard resolutions, you could set like a custom resolution that matches pixel density rather than the actual screen resolution type of thing. I can't imagine that it will end up looking good, I guess, in the long run.
I mean, you can tweak the dots per inch setting inside of Windows 7. You know, it's going to probably look awful on at least one of those screens.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's, you know, LEDs, you basically LEDs want to run at their natural resolution by adjusting the dots per inch. You're essentially, you know, it's kind of like hitting control plus, plus, plus on a web page. You know, the graphics start to look really awful as they get blown up. You know, it's basically control panel, display icon, personalize, and you're going to have to think through the display length, the screen resolution, and then go into make text and other items larger or smaller. And, you know, I want to say you really don't have a lot of options. It's like 96 DPI. Here it is, 96 DPI, 120 DPI, and 144 DPI. And then you can click on it, setting up a custom text, basically a custom text size for that, and you can scale it basically percentage of normal size. But I think you're going to be really frustrated. You know, you're going to get something where the ruler is going to be correct, like the distance is going to be correct between the monitors, but I think it's going to look really awful. That said, if you want to go in there and use the, you know, if you want to set up custom scaling and see if it works for you, Brent, definitely email us back and see if you like that. But I suspect one of those monitors is going to look really awful compared to the monitors.
Yeah, it's almost like, I don't know if a tool exists to do this, but I would imagine that there could exist a tool that kind of works like iFinity, where it creates one seamless screen resolution across it, but maybe it's not square, right? So you could have this match, or when I'm doing like a square match the square a little bit lower, so you kind of have a surface that is not 90 degree angles on either side. That would be a really cool piece of software that maybe somebody should write or do, because that would fix his problem, and it would fix, you know, I can imagine many use cases for that where you don't have monitors that are perfectly at the same height or the perfect with, we've got, you know, dual 30s set up at several places that are different models, and they don't match up perfectly. It's just one of those things we kind of get, you know, get over and get used to. But there's no easy way to do it, I guess, is what we're trying to tell you, unfortunately. Unless you find one of those tools.
Yeah. That's why I always try to buy, you know, to a certain degree, you can use a couple of monitors side by side that you got at different eras or different epochs of monitor construction. But if you are a Photoshop jockey, if you are a video editor, if you like to, it can be really frustrating, you know, also because the color is not going to match across the multiple monitors without calibration. And sometimes even if you do calibrate it, you know, you're having to deal with issues with color calibration, brightness.
Right.
I had to stop using them on one particular situation. I had to stop using two monitors side by side because I could not get the one monitor was so bright, even minimized. It was still like watching my pixels blow up. excuse me, watching my pupils kind of explode as they tried to go from, you know, the nice bright monitor, less bright monitor, no matter what I did.
Yeah.
So it's always nice if you can, when you're setting up multi-monitor environments, to get all of the monitors and have them be all of the same model bought around the same time. So hopefully everything at least is remotely close as you're moving from monitor to monitor to monitor, because it can be incredibly frustrating.
It is. It took me many years of having a multi-monitor setup before I realized that there was even a solution like a colorimeter that would do this very thing, where one monitor was very blue, and you could tell when you have just one screen, it's hard to tell these imperfections, right? But when you have two side by side and you go, well, this one looks kind of yellow and that one looks kind of blue, when reality is neither of them are correct. Right. And we talked about it, I think, several times on this. For that specific problem, I use a Pantone Huey device, which is like $80, $70 maybe. I think you might be even getting cheaper than that on Amazon, that sticks on your monitor, has a little suction cup, reads colors from it and adjusts things, and really nice there. But that's not going to help with the whole pixel lining up issue for Brent. But what do you think? One more? You want to do one more email?
Yeah, should we get one more on displays in while we're sure, talking displays? Damien's got a question about 2560 by 1440 displays. Ryan said during the 680 live show that 1440p monitors would be out later this year at around $500. I want to know if those are from tier one manufacturers, or are we going to be dealing with companies we don't know? I asked because I'm building a high-end Ivy Bridge based system later this year, and so far only HP's ZR2740W and Samsung's 27A50D are on my list. Asus had theirs at CES, then went cold. So should I even bother to pay attention to this space before October? That's an interesting question. I thought you mentioned HP being one of the first low cost
you know, high resolution 30 inch or 27 inch flat panels coming out.
I think so. And I remember which one he's talking about that Asus showed a 27 inch 2560 by 1440 display. It might have even been, no, I can't be right. I was going to say it might have been a 3D one, but I would have really, really been excited about that one if that were the case. but let's see. I was looking through here because he mentioned one. He mentioned a couple specifically, but I haven't heard anything about the Asus one at all. Although they make a wide range of monitors. They make some inexpensive ones that are decent, but you know, you get your pay for kind of level, and they have some of the professional series IPS displays that are really, 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 really nice. And it wouldn't surprise me to see that their 2560 would be kind of in that higher end echelon there when it does eventually come out. I think we'll see Samsung. Probably some of their lower end line will do that, because I'm looking right now and we're looking at $800, $700. See, they have a 3D 27 inch, but it's 1080p from Asus. It's hit or miss, but I don't think it will be all cheap brands that are going to come out with that, because when that glass is finally released, when it is more mainstream, it's still going to be more expensive than the cheapy monitor brands are really going to want to push. So, you know, I'd expect ViewSonics and Samsung and Asus to kind of all be, maybe by June, July timeframe. We'll see. The first couple of weeks of June is Computex, right? That's the big trade show over in Taipei. I imagine that there will be a lot of monitor focus, and hopefully we'll see some of this 2560 by 1440 type stuff over there as well. I don't know. Have you seen any other kind of deals on this, Patrick, or any more 2460 by 1600 displays maybe?
No. I keep coming every so often. It's kind of funny. They're starting to show up more often at the Dell outlet, which means that, you know, to me that more people are buying them, or more people are buying them and then having, you know, cold feet and canceling their orders. But I still haven't, I'm still waiting for me to be on Amazon or Newegg or in a shop and be like, oh, there it is, the 27 inch high resolution flat panel of my dreams. Because I keep seeing it, you know, I keep rolling down Costco and I keep seeing this one 27 inch Samsung, and I'm like, yes, there, it's 1080p. I don't want it. So, you know, I'm still circling. I need to like sell something so I can turn around and buy that monitor I so desperately want from the Dell outlet. But I also don't want to buy that unbelievably awesome ultra sharp 27 inch high res monitor and then have everybody else come out with great $500 high res monitors later this year.
Well, the HP ZR2740 is $679.99 on Newegg. And that is a 2560 by 1440. It has mixed reviews. It only has 8 or 9 reviews on here. But one of the 1-star reviews is it only has dual link DVI and DisplayPort interface. And right. I'm like, that's on purpose. Like it's got to have a dual link connection. And the reason these monitors are going to be less expensive is because they don't have a scaler built into them. And that's why you can't just plug in an HDMI connection directly to it that, you know, only does 1080p. Same way with the first generation of all the 30-inch panels I have, only have a dual-link DVI input. The 3008 WFP from Dell that we have a couple of does have a scaler, and you can do all those, but they were a little bit more expensive. But the next jump over HP is the Samsung model that is $850, and then it goes up to $1,100, and as we know, sad things happen when we get to more expensive results there, but... I still think it's going to happen definitely before the holidays. It would not surprise me to see a lot more information come out in June at Computex, and maybe we'll be able to nail down release dates then as well.
There you have it. So what's coming up on PC Per this week outside of us all fervently awaiting the 690 to show up for benchmarking?
Yeah. So, basically all the stuff that I said last week, because I was a slacker and I went out of town and I didn't finish any of it. The 680 SLI testing, the 680 SLI versus 7970 Crossfire performance results with 3 panels. We did a whole lot of benchmarks on the triple panel type stuff. So we'll have full results on that. And then more actual Z77 results based on Sandy Bridge now. We can't test with Ivy Bridge yet until whenever the Ivy Bridge processor is released. But Z77s, you can go, I think, out to Newegg today and buy. So if you can buy it, we can review it. So yeah, Gigabyte has Z77 boards on Newegg. So does ASUS, ASRock, MSI. Yeah, Z77 boards abound. So lots of that coming up. How about on Techzilla? Have you recovered from initial new baby syndrome?
Kind of. I was doing great with initial. I was doing great with sort of baby syndrome, initial new baby syndrome, right up to the point where, you know, feeding the baby at midnight gave me an opportunity to, like, you know, try to finish testing a new sub-$100 Blu-ray player, and which turned out to be a nightmare that ended finally with, you know, me halfway through the last episode of the season with a crashed Blu-ray player from a major manufacturer who shall remain named next week. And sitting there thinking, like, gosh, if you hit the home button, shouldn't it take you to the home screen? Do you really need to cold reboot a Blu-ray player to eject a disc when it's when the Blu-ray player is having a bad day? I will be beating a particularly irritating, affordable but incredibly irritating Blu-ray player. And my IOSafe G3 review, I thought I was going to do Wednesday this week. That's IOSafe's external enclosure that's, you know, flame-proof, waterproof, hurricane-proof, dog-proof. I had to delay that because it just pissed down rain all weekend in Alameda, so I couldn't put it on the barbecue. That's the fun test for that one, is I'm going to toss that thing in a 900-degree barbecue for an hour and see whether or not I can get my data back off of it when it's done, which is going to kill me because if you haven't seen it, it's really pretty. It's really pretty.
It's also pretty heavy. It's definitely weighty.
You do not drop it.
Make sure you don't do damage to your barbecue. I don't want any parts to melt off and ruin and not be able to grill out for the rest of the summer. So.
No. This may also be. I was tempted to actually put in a traditional plastic external drive enclosure on the grill with this, so you could see the dripping mess, and then I would of course have an excuse to go out and buy a new grill. I don't mention this to my wife; she may not approve of
the system here. Just between you and me,
you and me and the internet, and that's it for this week in computer hardware. We'll see you next week. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.